Well, good morning. My name is Tim Port. I'm one of the pastors here for Faith Community. Thank you for joining with us here this morning. If you're a guest here or one of your first times being with us, thank you for taking the time out on this blizzard-like day to be with us today. Now, our hope is that you'd be able to connect with us and that God would meet you during our time here together. As a church, let me let you know a little something about us. We're seeking to learn how to follow after Jesus. And to learn to follow after Jesus means we need to know the Bible, and we need to know exactly what it means and exactly what it says so we can know who this God is and we can follow after him. And so one of the opportunities for you after the service, if you'd like, is if I say anything that's unclear or you've got questions about the passage that we're looking at here today, or you're wondering how can I take this next step in following after Jesus, I'll be right up here right after the service for about 15 minutes or so. Come on up, and I'd love to chat with you for a little bit and see what God might be doing. Back in May, I took our boys to see the latest Avengers movie, Avengers Infinity War. And all three of us liked the previous Avengers movies, and so my expectations for Infinity War were pretty high. Though as a kid, I watched a lot of Spider-Man cartoons, and I read Spider-Man cartoons. I was not familiar with the Avengers that much and with this series on the Infinity War series. And I wanted to experience this series just in the movies. I didn't want to do any background research or anything like that about what the storyline of the Avengers Infinity War series was all about. And that worked against me in going to see this movie, Infinity War, because all the other movies that I went to in the Marvel Avengers series were all about the good guys winning and the bad guys being destroyed. And when I'm stressed out, like I was last spring, there's something comforting about knowing and going and seeing a movie and knowing that the good is going to win and the evil is going to be punished. But that's not what happened in Infinity War. And if you haven't seen it, a little bit of a spoiler alert here is that for me, this movie was actually quite depressing. I went in hoping that there would be victory, and I went in and seeing and experiencing only defeat. All of my favorite heroes were being destroyed. No one could stop the villain Thanos from destroying all kinds of people. The Hulk couldn't stop him. Thor couldn't stop him. The resources of Wakanda couldn't stop him. It was one big movie of defeat, and quite frankly, I left the movie feeling absolutely defeated. Is there no answer to the wickedness of Marvel Universe? Could the galaxy's mighty heroes not stop wickedness and evil from taking place? Now, as I pay attention to my heart, there's something that I go to movies for, and I think you do too. We read certain stories and we watch certain movies because our hearts long for a day, and we long for goodness to overcome, and we long for evil to be put back right. Now, in living our lives with courage in a broken world, it's going to take knowing that that there will be an end to wrong. There will be an overcoming of right. And that's one of the reasons why the book of Esther was written. It's to remind us that God keeps his promises, and because God is loyal to his promises, we can live with courage until we see him face to face. Esther was written, it's a true story, but it was written to remind us that God keeps his promises, and that creates courage. Evil will be overcome. The enemy will be overcome. God will overcome the enemy. We're concluding our series on courage and loyalty today, and we're finishing up the book of Esther. We've looked at the book of Ruth and now the book of Esther. And let me catch us up just on the storyline of the book of Esther. Then we're going to look at a passage here. Esther begins chapter 1 with a king, with the people of Israel living in dispersion in the empire of Persia. Persia is ruled by a king. We know him as Xerxes, but in the passage in our Bibles, he's also called Ahasuerus. And he banishes his wife in chapter 1, Vashti, the queen, because she does not obey his orders to come into this big party where he's showing off his wealth and his power to his military leaders. He seeks to replace this queen, Queen Vashti. So he makes a search of all the beautiful women in Persia to find this new queen. And these women were forced into rigorous beauty treatments for a year before they spend the night with the king. And the whole system is, if you spend the night with the king, you sleep with the king likes you, you will become his queen. If he doesn't like you, you will go into his harem and he might call on you at some other point in time. But you cannot marry anybody else once you've been with the king. Through this process, he finds Esther, a beautiful young Jewish girl. She hides her Jewish identity. She sleeps with the king. The king has favor for her, and she becomes his queen. And it seems like everything's going to be okay for Esther. She's hidden her Jewish identity. She's going to fit right in. But then in chapter 3, scene 3, a man named Haman is elevated to the highest place of the kingdom, just a little bit lower than King Xerxes. And Haman is a prideful man, and there was an order even given that all people are to bow before Haman, but there's one man who will not bow before Haman. His name is Mordecai, and he just happens to be a relative of Esther's. Haman is furious that Mordecai is refusing to bow to him, and so Haman finds out that Mordecai is a Jew, and Haman is filled with such hate that he desires not only to punish Mordecai, but to destroy all the Jewish people living in Persia. And Haman goes to King Xerxes and tricks him, doesn't tell him what people he wants to have destroyed, but he persuades Xerxes to give authority to have the Jewish people be destroyed, exterminated from Persia. Mordecai and Esther's plan to keep her Jewishness hidden, to sort of blend in, isn't going to keep her safe anymore now that this royal edict has gone out into all the empire. She needs to come out of hiding and risk her life for her people. She has to go into the king, even though it's illegal for anybody to go into the king's presence without being called for. She has to go into the king's presence, and if he does not approve of her coming into him, she will be killed, executed. Well, the king approves of her coming in, and all she does is ask. He asks, I'll give you anything you want, Esther, up to half of my kingdom. And she simply asks her one thing: come to a feast with Haman with me that I want to hold for you. So he does. And then at the feast, Xerxes asks, what do you want from me, Esther? What do you want? And she says, I just want one other thing. Come to another feast with Haman. And, okay, great. I'll do that too. And it's at this second feast then where Esther finally tells Xerxes that someone has plotted to kill her and her people. King Ahasuerus says to Queen Esther, who is this and where is he who is declared to do this? And right then and there, Esther confronts her enemy and she says these words, a foe, an enemy, that wicked Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Haman is terrified to learn that Esther is a Jew, and Xerxes is furious because he knows that he's been tricked and he knows that this Haman has plotted to kill his wife. Xerxes leaves the feast for a moment, and while he's out, Haman starts to plead with Esther, and he grabs onto her clothes and he starts to beg her, don't let me be destroyed. And as he's begging and grabbing under her clothes, Xerxes just happens to walk in and he sees that, Haman is assaulting his queen. How dare Haman do this? This results in Haman being hung from the very gallows that he had built to kill Mordecai. Then Mordecai is elevated to the place of highest honor where Haman used to be. And then, though Xerxes doesn't overturn the royal decree to have all the Jews exterminated, he does issue another royal decree authorizing that the Jews can defend themselves against the attack. And they overcome. They're preserved for another generation. This is an amazing story. It's a story of reversal. It's a story of reversal. The bad guy gets punished, and the good guys win. At least so it seems. And so with that as the overarching story, I want to look at one passage here today to see how God keeps his promises to overcome our enemy. We're looking at chapter 6. This is the pivot of the whole story of the book of Esther. We're going to look at chapter 6, pages 413 through 414. It's on the Bibles. It'll be in the Bibles in front of you, page 413, and also on the screens above. You can open up your tablet or your smartphone. Just make sure the vibration is on, right? As we read through. Chapter 6. On that night, the king could not sleep. And he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold, who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Man, I cannot get that out today. I am sorry. Sheesh. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing's been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set, and let the robes and the horse be handed over to to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Sort of get the feeling Haman's thought about this, don't you? Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse as you have said, and do so to the man Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned." So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Sort of wonder, don't you, if he was saying it with that kind of energy? Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, again, what happens in the Haman and Esther and Mordecai story is similar to other justice stories that you and I love, that we like to view and watch. The evil character is punished and the enemy is overcome by a great, great reversal. God is, though, in this central, and what we see here is that this chapter begins the reversal of fortunes for Haman and for Mordecai. Up to this point in the story of Esther, we're not sure how this is going to work out, but chapter 6, everything starts to change. God starts to show his hand. Even though he is hidden in the story and his name is never mentioned in the story, you have to see his actions. God works in the ordinary things. So chapter 6 begins this way. On that night, the king could not sleep. Everything begins to turn right here. The hidden God is starting to show his work on behalf of his people. Xerxes asks to have the book of Chronicles read, and that Chronicles records what happens to the king and the royal decisions. It was a log of the activities surrounding all the king and his works. And it just so happens that when the attendant opens up the book of the Chronicles, it lands on the page that deals with Mordecai the Jew and describes how Mordecai helped foil the murderous plot against King Xerxes that was plotted back in chapter 3. Now, as a way to protect themselves against further assassination attempts, what kings would do is that they would honor those who protected them. And so that's why Xerxes asks, what was done for this Mordecai? Because he protected me, and I want to celebrate people protecting me so that more people protect me. And he finds out, and it just so happens that this night when he cannot sleep, he finds out that nothing had been done to honor Mordecai. A little bit of a difference between Mordecai and Haman, isn't it? Mordecai is overlooked from the reward, but Haman doesn't get a bow from Mordecai, and he goes enraged. Now, Haman has no idea what's going on in Xerxes' mind. He has no idea about the plan. He has no idea about the sleepless night, and he comes into the king's quarters. He's brought in, he's invited in, and Haman is only preoccupied with himself, his murderous plot, his purposes, and his self-importance. And so when Xerxes asks Haman, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? He can only imagine that the king is talking about him. Now, every time I read this part of the story, I got to confess, I feel at least three emotions going on in me. One is a bit of a cringe, like, really, Haman? You can be that self-focused? There's nobody else in the whole empire that the king might want to honor more than you? So you get a little cringy. I also feel a grand deal of delight. Ah, finally, this Haman who has been preoccupied with murderous works is going to get what he is due. Finally, the tables are being overturned. But then also, I feel a little bit of dread. Quite frankly, because I could see myself doing exactly what Haman did. Haven't you done that? Somebody tells you a report about something, or did you make it about yourself? It's so easy to make things about ourselves. One of the reasons why we talk a lot about pride and humility here at Faith Community Church, we've got books out in our cafe area where you can purchase that help us move from pride to humility, is because everybody has pride, and nobody thinks their pride is as bad as somebody else's. And your pride, not somebody else's, your pride will destroy you. Because God opposes the proud, and he gives grace to the humble. Now that's Haman. Back to the story. There is this awesome, ironic reversal in the story. Haman believes he is the one whom the king delights to honor, so Haman prescribes to Xerxes what he would love to experience from the king. And then Xerxes, though, tells Haman, go and do everything that you've just said. Leave nothing out, but do it for Mordecai. Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do it for Mordecai the Jew. Again, imagine what it was like for Haman to lead Mordecai through the streets, receiving the honor that he so wanted from the king, that he had prescribed for himself. And here he is announcing, this is what the king does for the one he delights to honor. Now again, this is the first of many reversals in the Haman experience that Haman experiences. The gallows that were built for Mordecai to be hung on, Haman eventually becomes hung on those. The wicked Haman is overcome. The enemy of Mordecai, the enemy of Esther, the enemy of the Jews, the enemy of God himself is overcome. God gives him over to his pride, and he is destroyed in his own destructive, murderous devices. There's a part of this that goes, yes, this is the way it should be. Now, I need to ask you a question. Why do our hearts like stories like this? We love ironic justice-type stories as human beings. We love it when the bad guys lose and the good guys win. Why? It's because our hearts long for justice. Your heart, my heart, our hearts are made for justice. Our hearts long for evil to be overcome. Our hearts know that there's something wrong with the world, that things are not right. We long for the wrongness of the world to be fixed, to be put right. This is why I left Infinity Wars so discouraged. There was no hope to overcome the great villain in the storyline. All the galaxy's greatest heroes couldn't overcome Thanos. I left discouraged. The movie felt like real life. There is no end to the evil. Now, I mention this to call attention to our heart's desire for justice, for wrongs to be righted. I mention this because often I and others, I was just hearing about somebody this week who's wrestling with this, we wonder, how is it that there can be a good God when there is so much evil in life, when I've experienced so much evil in life? It's hard to put it together. If you're wrestling with that question, you need to know that you're in good company. We don't have all the answers. The Bible gives us some answers, some really good, important answers, and we've got sermons dedicated to those. But the Bible doesn't give us all the answers to why there is evil in the world and what God is going to do about it and what God's up to and the ever-present question in the midst of difficulty, why? We don't always know why. But there's a different question that I'd like to recommend that you ask. If you ever wrestle or when you wrestle with why is there, or if there's so much evil in the world, how can there be a good God? I want to give you a different question to ask. The question's this. If there isn't a good God, if there isn't a good God that exists, how do I know what evil is? And why in the world do we all long for justice to be done against wicked things? That's an important question to ask. Why do these reversal stories speak so deeply to our hearts? Why do our hearts get so encouraged when evil is punished and good is rewarded? See, the Bible's answer to that is because we're made to live in a world that is just and beautiful and good. That's how God has made us. So our desire for justice harkens back to a time when the world was perfect, when the world was good, when the world was beautiful. There was no evil in the world at one point in time. Our hearts long for stories like this because it's not only what it was like, it's we know that there's a sense of what the world should be really like. We all have a sense of it's not the way it's supposed to be. It should be another way. But these stories also tell us that there will be a day, there will be a day when all evil is made right. All wickedness is overturned. What went wrong? Well, we see it in Haman. What's absolutely wrong with the human species, with history, is pride. Why do we love to see prideful people fall? Because we know intuitively that pride is wicked and horrible. We know that humility is good. See, evil began in the human story when our first parents, Adam and Eve, when they first rebelled against God, they thought they knew better than God. That's pride. They ate fruit from a forbidden tree. They disobeyed God. They thought that they knew better. But what the Bible's getting at is that God is going to do a great reversal. God is going to do a great reversal. And it's just pictured here a little bit in Haman and Mordecai. It's just pictured a little bit. God promises to bring a reversal to all the evil that's done in the world. What we see in this instance of Haman and Mordecai is what the Apostle Paul says later on in Romans 8, that God causes all things to work together for good. That doesn't mean we're going to experience good things only in life if we belong to him. It means that God is so great, so grand, so powerful that he can subjugate all wickedness, all things that happen to us, and force every single thing in your life, every single thing in human history, including the Hamans of the world, and force it to do you good. That's what God is about. That's what God is about. God will subjugate all wrongs and force them to do us good. Now, it'd be sort of easy, I think, to look at the story of Esther and Mordecai and Haman and think and just sort of put it in the box of our normal reversal justice stories where evil people are punished and good people are elevated. But that's not fully what's going on with Esther and Mordecai and Haman. Yes, Haman is punished because of his evil. Yes, that is true. But Mordecai and Esther are not delivered and honored. they're not rewarded because they're good. There's something else going on in the story. They are courageous, they are loyal, but there's something else going on in the story. We read through it in chapter 6. The reason why Mordecai is able to overcome Haman, the reason why is because he's a Jew. Notice in verse 13 of chapter 6, we read through it. This is Haman's wife to him and also his wise men speaking to him. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but surely fall on him. It doesn't say because he's a good man, because he's of the Jewish people. The reason why Esther was able to overcome Haman is because God was on her side. Why? Because she no longer was hiding her Jewish identity. She was coming out and showing and revealing to Xerxes and to Haman that she is of the Jewish people. That's why. Now, how do we put this together? What does this mean? Now, ultimately, I think what the author of Esther is trying to teach us is that God keeps his promises no matter what, in every generation. I don't know if you remember or not, or if you were here 2 weeks ago, Glenn Hirschberger was with us, and he talked about how the mention of Haman being an Agagite was very important to the storyline. And yes, he was absolutely correct. It's important that in this book of Esther, there's only two nationalities that are mentioned. There's only two ethnicities that are mentioned in this story. The Jews and this Haman, the Agagite. It's mentioned in 3:1. King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite. Why is this being brought up? There's a little history we need to know to understand what's going on here. This mention of Haman being Agagite ties us into a promise that God made hundreds of years before the people of Israel were ever in Xerxes' Persian Empire. The word Agagite actually comes from the name of the king, of the Amalekite king named Agag, that Saul was supposed to destroy, but he didn't. And the reason why Saul was supposed to destroy King Agag and also the Amalekite people is because the Amalekite people were the first people to attack the people of Israel when they came out of Egypt. And when they did that, God made a promise. God made a promise to the people of Israel. God made a promise to Moses that in every generation, the Amalekites would be his enemy and he would fight for the people of Israel and fight against the Amalekites. God would fight against them. That's the reason why Haman is actually defeated. It's not because Mordecai is so good. It's not because Esther is so good. Whoops. It's because God keeps his promises. God keeps his promises. God fought against Haman because he was an enemy of God. He made himself an enemy of God's people, and God made his people's enemy his people. See, the book of Esther is not ultimately structured to teach about the courage and loyalty of Esther, though she was amazingly courageous. The book of Esther itself is actually structured to show the hand of God, to highlight God's hidden activity in promise keeping. Chapter 6 is the great reversal that only God could actually bring about. Now, how do we apply this? I think first, remember that God has made some astounding and great, powerful promises about righting wrongs in this world. And one of the reasons why you and I love these reversal stories, we love justice stories, we love the story of reversal of Haman and Mordecai in this. The reason why we do that is because we hunger for God to right the wrong world, and he promises that he will. And we see a glimpse of it. We see a glimpse of it here in this story. We see a glimpse of what Romans 8:28 looks like when God subjugates all things in life and forces them to do us good. God is doing that for Mordecai and Esther. This wicked plan that Haman schemes actually turns out to bless and to honor Mordecai. God is giving us a glimpse. He's giving us a glimpse of what he will do. to those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. But more specifically, what God is telling us is that our enemy will be overcome. Our enemy will be overcome. Now, unfortunately, we don't like to talk about our enemy that much. Sort of like Voldemort, we don't mention his name, we give it power. We like to distract ourselves from our enemy. It's one of the reasons why we have all our stuff, all our dingers on our devices. We don't want the quiet and have to think about our enemy. But every now and again, we're forced to come to grips with the fact that you and I, we have an enemy. And sometimes it surprises us. 2 weeks ago, I was driving in the car with our youngest son, Seth, who's wonderfully tender-hearted. He was in the front seat next to me, and we're going to a flag football game or practice. My hand was on the gear shifter, and he looked down at my hand, and then he took my hand in his hands, and he was looking at my hand, and he was moving the skin around. You know, stretching it and stuff, right? And then squishing it together. And then he looked at the back of his hand. And then a tear started to form. Now, I knew exactly what was going on, because I had done the same thing with my grandfather when I was his age. But I wanted him to give voice to some of the emotions that were going on in his heart. So I said, "Seth, why are you sad?" He just looked down at my hand. So, "Dad, you're getting old." And then he said, "You're going to die. You're going to die." Now, there's been times in my life when that statement, "You're going to die," would bring great terror into my heart. And I didn't want to think about it, and I didn't want to have anything to do with it. But this time, I was able to say, "You know, Seth, you're right. I'm going to die. So are you. But we have someone who's overcome our greatest enemy. And one day, this very body that you see right here that's going to die, it's going to rise again. It's going to rise again." See, the book of Esther isn't just about Esther. As I read at the start of the service, every book of the Bible whispers somebody else's name. And our greatest enemy is death itself. And there's no scientific advancement that we're going to be able to come up with that's going to overcome death. Can't reverse it. We can't reverse it. We need somebody else to do what we can't do. And the grand story of the Bible is that God has overcome our greatest enemy in a great reversal. Instead of Jesus coming in with all kinds of fanfare and with great power, Jesus comes in as a helpless baby and he becomes one of us. He lives the life that we are intended to live. He dies the death that you and I deserve to die. And because he did that, in that great reversal, he rose from the grave. And dying in our place, death was actually defeated. Here's the great reversal that God has accomplished. In the death of Jesus, the death of death actually happened. Actually happened. And because Jesus rose from the grave, he tells us, you and me, because I live, you also will live. See, we won't overcome death by medical advancement. We won't overcome it by our own strength. We won't overcome it, but we can participate in it just as Mordecai, just as Esther did. They identified with being Jews. And the only way that we can overcome death is by identifying by being with Jesus, belonging to him. Because it's Jesus who says, "Come with me, because I live, you also will live. You also will live." The Apostle Paul, later writing after the resurrection of Jesus, says, "As in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive." The story of Esther and Mordecai is the story of a great reversal. All the wicked things that happen in your life, God will subjugate and force them to do your good. But even more than all of that, your greatest enemy has already been overcome. And all you have to do is identify with the one who's overcome. Believe in him. Give him your whole life. And you can overcome the one thing you can't do on your own strength. He's already done it. May God's loyalty to his promises give you great, unflinching courage. to live in this life until you see Jesus face to face. Will you stand with me as I pray? Father, thank you for your goodness, your kindness, and your grace. God, would you speak courage into our hearts as we remember your faithfulness, that you are our defender, that you hand us our enemy's head. You have overcome. Thank you, God. Amen.